Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 20th of May, these are our main stories. Researchers say carbon emissions fell by more than a sixth at the height of the global lockdown. The head of the World Health Organization has once again defended its handling of the pandemic. A new law in Hungary says transsexual people will no longer be able to change their birth gender on official documents. Also in this podcast,
I don't think we've actually thought about what reopening the economy looks like for women who desperately need to go back to work.
The gender inequality, which existed before the pandemic and has now got a lot worse, according to many American women. The wave of lockdowns and devastated economies around the world have left skies clear of aeroplanes and streets free of cars, leaving many people wondering, could COVID-19 actually be good for the environment? Well, a new study here in the UK has estimated that global carbon emissions fell by more than a sixth at the height of the global lockdown. But researchers say results varied from country to country, as the report's lead author, Professor Corinne Le Kerry, explains.
We've seen a lot of differences between countries that were under complete lockdown, where there were emission drops of 30 to 40%. So France, Denmark, New Zealand had 41% decrease in emission, and other countries that had either a milder form of lockdown or not the whole countries was under shelter at home measure, like Canada, Chile, Turkey, where it was more like 15 or 20%.
Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath told me more.
We've had a series of reports now all confirming what pretty much everybody knows when they look out the window. There are not as many planes flying. We've seen there are not as many cars on the streets and people are not going to work, so they're working from home. All that has a knock-on effect on the amount of carbon being produced by people. And in this latest report, it suggests that 17 million tonnes less carbon per day has been produced per day compared to last year, which is a significant amount, and that's what the latest report actually documents.
But is the worry now that this is only temporary because of the pandemic?
Yeah, that's the big question here. Most of the reduction we've seen has come from cars. Almost half the reduction in emissions has come from people not driving as much and less trucks and etc. on the roads. The big fear now is among the scientists is that as restrictions are lifted in many parts of the world, people will take to the cars as opposed to going in public transport because they're probably afraid of catching the virus on trains and underground systems. So the worry is that they'll go back in the cars and that emissions could actually rise higher than they have been in the past. And the scientists involved are urging governments to take significant steps to make sure that that doesn't happen.
And what are those possible steps?
The scientists say that, look, this is a really golden moment in some respects. Despite the global tragedy that the pandemic has brought, it is a great chance to somehow change the things we've been doing. So they want governments to invest money, put more priority on cycling and walking where that's possible. They want people, governments to stop subsidising airlines, for instance. They don't want people to be giving money to bail out airlines without some environmental strings. And they say, look, this is a great time. If you look back at the great financial crash in 2008, 2009, governments then invested in solar and wind power. As a result of that, the prices of those renewables fell. They say right now, electric cars and electric car batteries are in a similar position. If there's big investment from governments, the prices could fall rapidly, and that could allow the world to move on to a different form of transport, and that would have a significant impact on emissions.
And are they optimistic that people have changed their habits because of lockdowns around the world and actually won't get back in their cars and will walk and will get on bikes?
I think they don't believe that that's the case at all, because I think they recognise that this is a drastic response to an emergency situation. Nobody would have chosen to do this. And as soon as the pressure is off, they imagine people will go back to their cars in huge numbers. What they say it does offer is the opportunity for governments to put in place new investments all the economies around the world have essentially stopped. They need to be rebooted. And there's a great chance for those governments to do that on a green footing rather than investing in the old reliables of the fossil fuel industries.
Matt McGrath. The head of the World Health Organization has defended its handling of the coronavirus pandemic. The WHO has been sharply criticized by the United States and will be the subject of an independent inquiry. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the organization wanted accountability more than anyone. And he added that, as devastating as the virus is, it had provided mankind with the opportunity to work together to forge a common future.
Dark and difficult days may lie ahead, but guided by science together, we will overcome. Let hope be the antidote to fear. Let solidarity be the antidote to division. Let our shared humanity be the antidote to our shared threat. Now, more than ever,
in the past 24 hours, President Trump has escalated his attack on the WHO, threatening to permanently cut off funding over its response to COVID-19. In a letter on Monday, he accused it of failing to share information in a timely and transparent fashion and being too soft on China, where the virus originated. And Mr. Trump gave the WHO a deadline of 30 days to reform. So, what's the case against the WHO? Chris Morris is from the BBC's Reality Check.
This is talking about the early phase of the outbreak, really. Now, what the WHO says, it was informed by China of a pneumonia of unknown cause on the 31st of December last year. Within a few days, it had put out an official statement asking for more information from China. And by the 20th and 21st of January, it sent a team to Wuhan to investigate. By the end of the month, it declared a global public health emergency. Now, you can argue that perhaps it could have acted quicker, but you can certainly make that argument against many governments around the world as well, including that of the United States. And I think the key point in this, the crucial point, is that the WHO doesn't have the power to force or compel any government to do anything, including handing over information. And it seems like in the absence of that power, it decided, rightly or wrongly, that by praising China publicly, that would be the best way to get what is obviously still a secretive society to cooperate. Is the WHO pro-Chinese? Certainly China is very active in the organisation, and the WHO is aware of that and sensitive to it. Perhaps its critics would certainly say oversensitive. I think when you talk to all experts, the overwhelming majority of scientists say, by all means, criticise the WHO. But the idea of cutting off funding for the only truly global public health body we have in the middle of a global pandemic, any expert will tell you that's dangerous.
Chris Morris. From nurses to pharmacists to grocery store workers, the majority of essential jobs in the US during the pandemic are held by females. But many of these women are still responsible for more domestic work and childcare than their male partners. The gender disparity existed before the pandemic and has got worse, as Katty Kay reports.
More states are starting to get back to business now.
Slowly, America is opening some doors. Shopping malls in Texas, hair salons in Georgia, even tattoo parlors in Tennessee. But until someone opens schools and childcare centers, millions of women can't go back to work.
60% of the job loss in February and March was women.
Cecile Richards is a well-known women's rights activist, founder of the political action group Supermajority.
I don't think we've actually thought about what reopening the economy looks like for women who desperately need to go back to work.
And yes, this is still largely a female issue. A New York Times poll suggests women still do most of the housework and most of the childcare, lockdown or no lockdown.
Wait, can I have cake?
No, you cannot have cake for breakfast. Sorry, dude.
On top of which, they are juggling full-time jobs. It's a lot.
Do you have anything?
Women like Megan Ranney, an emergency doctor in Providence, Rhode Island. She's also the mother of two children who are stuck at home. Oh, and she's a researcher too. If she sounds a little overwhelmed right now, it's because she is.
The first difficult part is that as an ER doc, my day-to-day is not standard, right? Some days I work a morning or daytime shift. Sometimes I work in the evening. Sometimes I work overnight. And with COVID-19, there's even more unpredictability. We'll get called in last minute or called off last minute. So trying to balance teaching of my kids, making sure they don't just spend their whole day sitting in front of the screen, has been really tough. Code blue.
Women aren't dying as often as men from COVID-19, but in America, they are the foot soldiers in the battle against it. More than two-thirds of grocery store and fast food checkout staff are women. And almost 80% of America's healthcare workers are women, which comes as no surprise to Dr. Rani.
It is a helping profession and a service profession. And with our empathy and care, it's been that many of us are attracted to it inherently as an extension of the way that many of us were raised and the way that we see ourselves in the world.
For some working women, the virus, though, has brought welcome changes.
Around and over. Do two more for me, okay?
In Canada, Dr. Erin Zimmerman's freelance writing used to fit in around her two young kids. When the pandemic hit, her husband's medical clinic was closed and he lost his income.
Now I'm also the sole income earner for a family of four. So whereas my work was pretty invisible before, now it's much more central and I need to have my time without my children being able to interrupt, which has been a shift for them.
It's been a change for her husband too.
So he went from 60 hours a week, a full on out of the home career, to suddenly finding himself at home.
I think he's finding it a bit surprising to learn how hard it is to be with kids full time. Yeah, it looks easy from the outside.
Erin enjoys her new status, but she can already see that her husband's office will open before her children's school does, and that will put her job back in a supporting role.
With every man utilized, we are still short millions of hands. We must call upon women.
During World War II, millions of American women surged into the workforce, taking jobs their men had left behind. But after the war, the men needed those jobs back, and the women were fired. Today, America is relying on women as essential workers. Will it remember how critical they were after this pandemic is over?
Employers find that women can do many jobs as well as men, some jobs better.
That ends that report from Cathy Kay. Well, with lockdowns easing in many countries, many people are starting to think about the chance to go on holiday. And countries across Europe are considering ways to persuade tourists to visit this summer, despite coronavirus restrictions. From Brussels, Kevin Connolly reports.
Of all the challenges presented by the need to unwind the interconnected restrictions of the lockdown across Europe, none is riskier or more complex than tourism. It will depend on a revival of supply and demand in the aviation sector and will require widespread reopening of cafes, restaurants and hotels, all with enhanced sanitary measures and rules of social distancing. But the prospect of an increase in the supply of holidays in southern Europe will be of limited use to British travellers if they are required to quarantine themselves for 2 weeks after any trip abroad. Still, in countries which rely on summer tourism, planning is underway. Greece will allow internal tourism to its holiday islands from next week and plans to start welcoming foreign tourists at some point next month. Tourism accounts for 18% of the Greek economy and employs a fifth of the workforce. In Italian resorts like Rimini on the Adriatic coast, a new reality is taking shape. Beach umbrellas will be 4.5 metres apart and some will open and close by remote control. Public bathrooms will be sanitised automatically each time they're used, and beach lockers will be opened by contactless cards. Tourism may be planning a tentative return, but for now at least it will be profoundly changed by Europe's grim experience with COVID-19.
Kevin Connolly. Some other news now. Transsexual people in Hungary will no longer be able to change their birth gender on official documents, according to a law passed by Parliament. Nick Thorpe reports from Budapest.
The law is part of a wide-ranging package of legislation put forward by Deputy Prime Minister Zsolt Semjén at the height of the coronavirus emergency in Hungary. Under the law, gender at birth can no longer be changed on official documents, including identity cards, which Hungarians must carry at all times. A backlog of applications from the past 3 years will all be rejected. The government insists the new law was needed to end legal uncertainty and will not prevent anyone from expressing their identity. Trans people and human rights groups say it's the latest blow in a war declared by the conservative nationalist government against anyone who does not fit into their definition of a family.
Nick Thorpe. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come. A son is reunited with his parents 32 years after being abducted on the way home from nursery. The Syrian government has stepped up its attack on Rami Maklouf, a billionaire businessman and cousin of President Bashar al-Assad, who was until recently a key figure in the inner circle of the governing elite. An apparently official document has emerged ordering the seizure of Rami Maklouf's assets. Here's our Middle East editor, Jeremy Boone.
For many years, Rami Maklouf was a kingpin in the regime, which allowed him to build and own businesses worth billions of dollars. In Syria, he became a symbol of the regime's corruption. But he's fallen in a spectacular fashion, going public about a rift in the ruling family in a series of posts on social media, including three long videos. Mr. Maklouf has made criticisms of the regime, particularly its feared security agencies, which would have landed a Syrian from a more humble background in jail. The row is ostensibly about $180 million in unpaid tax owed by Syria's biggest mobile network, which is at the core of a Maklouf business empire that also includes oil and construction. But it's looking as if President Bashar al-Assad is zeroing in on his estranged cousin's vast fortune. Social media in the Middle East is full of theories about why the Assad and Maklouf clans have fallen out. Syria's treasury is broke after 9 years of war, so the president needs money. But it could be that Rami Maklouf, his childhood friend, became too big, too rich, and too powerful.
Jeremy Bowen. Germany's highest court has ruled that the country's Foreign Intelligence Service is not allowed to monitor and gather information from emails or internet data of people abroad. Journalists say the decision is a victory for press freedom, but some politicians say the ruling by the Constitutional Court will hamper the powers of German spies. Here's our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
This case was brought by foreign and German journalists, including some working in conflict zones, who believe their communications would have been intercepted by the BND, Germany's foreign intelligence agency. The court today said that the current system of collecting their data, keeping it and sharing it with others violated the fundamental right to privacy enshrined in Germany's constitution, arguing it was too broad and indiscriminate. In future, the court argued, foreigners overseas would need to be offered the same protection under the Constitution as Germans at home. But the court did not rule that the collection of the data and its retention was impossible. Rather, the ruling means that such practices will be possible in the future, but with tighter regulations and oversight. With its experience under Nazism and then under communism in the East, Germany has long valued its protections for privacy, and today they've been extended even beyond the country's own borders.
Gordon Carrera. Let's turn once again to the coronavirus, and one of the arguments President Trump has returned to repeatedly is that lockdowns also cause casualties, that, for example, lost jobs could also lead to lost lives because of depression and suicide. It's an argument echoed by his Treasury Secretary, Stephen Mnuchin.
There is the risk of permanent damage. And as I've said before, we're conscious of the health issues and we want to do this in a balanced and safe way.
So is there hard evidence that governments can use in charting a way out of lockdown by adding up the costs and benefits of maintaining or easing restrictions? Professor Jayanta Bhattacharya is a health economist at Stanford Medical School, and he told Tim Franks about the costs of lockdown.
There's indicators that those indirect deaths, especially for the poor in poor countries around the world, are likely to be very, very high. I don't think I would say that we know fully those numbers. there are a lot of decisions still left to be made that could change things. I'm increasingly alarmed that we're likely to see diseases that had been suppressed and successfully reduced, like polio, diseases that we were still very worried about, but and had made some progress against, malaria, tuberculosis. I'm very, very alarmed and afraid that those diseases might start to come back as efforts to combat COVID-19 often impinge on our ability to control diseases like those.
Tell me how that's the case, because some of the discussion that there has been in richer Western countries has been about possible knock-on to, say, cancer screening services. But how would diseases like malaria and polio have a resurgence in developing countries?
We tend to view in our Western countries just the policies in Western countries as the key thing. And I think they are key to health for a lot of places around the world, because the robust economies of the West fund a lot of the control efforts, but also the policies of poor countries as well around these lockdowns also impinge on these efforts. So, for instance, the vaccination efforts by the World Health Organization have been to some extent reduced as a result of the difficulty of doing vaccinations in the midst of lockdowns in developing countries. There's evidence that people are not vaccinating their children because they're afraid to bring their children into medical centers for basic vaccinations. So we're likely to see in both Western and non-Western countries sort of resurgence of some of these diseases as a result of reductions in control of the effort. There's a trade-off here. It's not simply let's protect ourselves from COVID-19. We need to think about the other conditions and other diseases that afflict mankind at the same time as we think about COVID-19, so that we don't save everyone from COVID-19 just to have the poor people around the world starve from the crushing depression that's likely to hit us.
Are you suggesting that perhaps with a lot of countries the balance is wrong then, that there has been, to put it crudely, an abundance of caution?
I think the problem is that there's no safe option. It's not possible to protect ourselves from COVID without paying cost in lives in other ways. Whatever choice we make is going to cost lives. I think many, many countries have focused so much. I mean, you can understand why. It's a new disease. These quarantines have costs in lives, and we really do need to consider those more. In basically every country on Earth should consider those more, the costs in decision-making about these policies.
And yet you'll be aware that a lot of people are saying that they are concerned that if lockdowns are eased too quickly, that there could be a second wave of infections, and that could be maybe even more ruinous than the first.
Lockdowns are not a policy that will lead to disease eradication. What they do is they delay the onset. That's the fear of the second wave, right? And that's a very real fear. What lockdowns do is delay the time until the second wave arrives. They don't save lives now. They change when people get the infection. Lockdowns are a kind of form of insurance policy. It's just that insurance policy comes at an enormous cost of the lives that we've been talking about. So the question is, how much are we willing to pay in those other lives for the lives that we save through the lockdown policy? If we do a lockdown and, okay, let's move forward 6 months, the world is in economic depression, we will be poorer as a world and less capable of dealing with a second wave than we would be today when we have more resources to cope with it.
Professor Jayanta Bhattacharya. But while many suffer from the lockdown, new research has found that there are those reporting they are more satisfied with life since the lockdown began and are experiencing a greater sense of personal well-being. Paul Moss reports.
It's the kind of club which offers pretty much everything. Futurini's in East London has always boasted an arty crowd, enjoying a variety of cocktails and cabaret shows. Futurini's is, of course, in lockdown right now, a prospect which the club's owner, Sophie Parkin, viewed initially with some alarm. She is, by any account, a socialite. So it's come as quite a surprise, Sophie says, that being stuck at home has left her with a deep sense of contentment.
I used to love to go from one bar to another, meet up with friends. So now the lockdown has come, I'm feeling so much calmer because nobody is saying, we've got to meet up, we've got to do this, nobody has to do anything. And isn't that blissful? I'm floating continuously.
Life before lockdown was very different for Lucy, her problems quite the opposite. A single mother, unable to go out very much. She says she always worried about the social events she couldn't ever be at. FOMO, as it's sometimes called, fear of missing out. Now, though, that's all gone.
There's something quite comforting that I found in this feeling of everybody being in the same boat. There's not that sense of I'm missing out on something. I've been spending a lot of time in nature, which has been a lot less stress. My sleep has been better and just generally feeling much more at peace.
Of course, the coronavirus lockdown has been a far from peaceful time for many. Those working on the front line in healthcare, people who've lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, and those who've lost their livelihoods. And yet, the lockdown itself does seem to have had some strikingly positive effects, according to a huge research project currently underway. A team from University College London have been conducting surveys with 90,000 British people every week, asking participants from a whole range of social, economic and ethnic backgrounds about their experience of lockdown. And the results have come as something of a surprise, according to the project's leader, Professor Daisy Fancourt.
Previous literature from other epidemics in the past has suggested that people actually get worse during quarantines. So it's interesting here that we're actually not finding that pattern. Since lockdown came in, for a lot of people, life's got a lot simpler. A lot of choice has been removed. We've had anecdotal reports from people that they're actually focusing a lot more on the things that they now perceive to be the most important in their lives.
That's certainly something Alison has appreciated. She moved out of her city home as lockdown began to a village where she was delighted to find she could record the sound of sheep being led down a nearby road. Life under lockdown is proving essentially therapeutic for Alison. She told me about the anxiety she was suffering beforehand.
I think it was a gradual build-up of things that really built up anxiety. Work pressure, I had some problems with my flat, and I actually had a panic attack. It was as if something was pressing down on my chest. I felt that I couldn't breathe. And so when the lockdown happened, it took everything out of my hands, all the pressures that were crowding in on me. It's allowed me to do things slowly, even the simplest task, like making a soup. And I have to admit that personally, I want the lockdown to continue.
And finally, a couple in China have been reunited with their son, 32 years after he was abducted as a toddler. Mao Yin's tireless parents had never given up hope of finding him, as our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton reports.
Over the years, the 1988 disappearance of two-year-old Mao Yin became one of China's most notorious child abduction cases. Not because the case was that unusual. Thousands of children are snatched and then sold by Chinese child trafficking rings every year. But Mao Yin's disappearance was never forgotten because his parents refused to stop actively searching for him. They traveled across China, handing out more than 100,000 pamphlets and volunteering with rescue groups, helping 29 other sets of parents find their missing children. Then, last month, a sudden breakthrough in the hunt for their own boy. Police in the Chinese city of Xi'an received a tip about a suspicious adoption dating back to the 1980s. They then used facial recognition technology to match old photos of Mao Yin, the toddler, with current photos from the province of Sichuan, where he was believed to have been sold. A digital match was verified by a DNA test, and then a heartfelt reunion filmed in front of dozens of news cameras. Facial recognition technology then gave way to another, more primal kind of facial recognition. Mao Yin, the boy, now a man, looks nearly identical to his long-lost father.
Celia Hatton on A Happy Ending. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.